Okay, Acts chapter 5 is where we've left off. We want to read Acts chapter 5, verses 8 through 10 in just a little bit. We've gone through Ananias as far as what happened with him. He comes before Peter. We talked about the lie. And now we want to turn to his wife. Acts chapter 5, starting with verse 8. And Peter, well, let's pick up with verse 7, even though that's where we stopped last time. And it was about the space of 3 hours after when his wife, not knowing what was done, came in. And Peter answered unto her, tell me whether ye sold the land for so much. And she said, yea, for so much. But Peter said unto her, how is it that ye have agreed together to try the Spirit of the Lord? Behold, the feet of them that have buried thy husband are at the door, and they shall carry thee out. And she fell down immediately at his feet, and gave up the ghost. And the young men came in and found her dead, and they carried her out and buried her by her husband. Now, one of the words that's interesting to me in verse 8 is the word answered. That word could indicate that Sapphira comes into the area where Peter was, and maybe she said something, and that it certainly is not improbable. She may have said, where's my husband? Have you seen my husband? Did the donation get made? And then Peter answered. But there's another possibility. And that other possibility is sometimes it's almost like you can read another person's mind, and you might answer them even though they've not said anything. Well, when you look at what Peter had as far as his ability with the Holy Spirit, he had been baptized in the Holy Spirit just like the other apostles. Maybe he answers her, not because she's verbally spoken, but because he knows what's in her mind. So that could be looked at in a couple of different ways. But Peter certainly was well-versed as far as what was going on, and he didn't take long to get to the issue at hand. He asked if Sapphira and her husband had sold the land for a specific amount of money. And that, of course, was the amount that was claimed by Ananias. And what did Sapphira say? Sure. Did she get her chance to square things up and make things right? Yep. And I think there's a lesson or two in that. And was Peter as strict with Sapphira as he was with Ananias? Yes, there were not two separate standards. It's been suggested that Peter was able to point to the money. And I think that's an interesting suggestion. Let's say that they got a gold bar or whatever it might have been, and maybe he actually pointed to that and said, is this what you got? And if that is true, then that may have been even a little more dramatic. Or it's possible, certainly, that he verbally stated the amount as well. But she did reject that second chance. And today, some people are given second chances, and they blow those as well. The word which is translated agreed together, you have that word being used in some other places as well. Remember over there in Matthew chapter 18, Jesus talked about if two of you shall agree as far as anything on the earth. That was in the context of resolving problems with fellow Christians. And here it means the couple agreed to lie and cheat as a team. Well, that would have been bad, but as we've noted in previous classes, who did they decide to lie to? They decided to lie to the Spirit of God or the Holy Spirit, and Peter made that clear that that was a big sin. He said that you've decided to try or tempt the Holy Spirit. The King James, I think, uses the word tempt. That word's used about 40 times in the New Testament, and one of those times would be in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 9. Back over there, Paul said that the Israelites had tempted God in the wilderness by their behavior. And you have Ananias and Sapphira doing the same thing here. They're putting to the test. They're putting God on trial. They are dealing with God in such a way to see if he's really going to notice and if he's going to respond somehow to the sin. And we find that's exactly what he did. Kind of interesting. What were the last words based on the text that Sapphira heard before she enters into eternity? What were the last words she heard?
That she heard?
She heard.
That her husband had died and she would too.
Yeah. Can you imagine the last words that you go into eternity thinking that your husband is dead and now you're going to join him? It's kind of like, wow. And even before, it sounds like she was able to perhaps really process that information. It hits her and then she leaves this life. So a very, very sad way to go. I've got a contrast to that. I'm going to hold that, though, for next week's sermon. But tempted to use it today, but it'd be better to save a week. So we'll hold on to that for a little while. And I think you'll find that interesting when we deal with that a week from today. When you look at what we have here, did she have any warning that death was coming?
No.
Now, for people today, I think all of us would prefer to know a little bit when death is going to come. Nobody wants to get really sick. Nobody wants to have cancer. Nobody wants to have a disease which is going to drag out for several months or several years. But if you look at everything as far as the totality of all the circumstances, in some respects that does give you a few advantages. Because if the doc says, okay, you have this disease, and probably within 6 months, your life is going to be gone, you're now looking at the clock a little differently than you might, where you think, okay, I'm 40 or 50 or 60, and I've got several years left, and everything's going to be great in one day. Well, that day doesn't come. So we don't know how old Ananias and Sapphira were. I'm kind of inclined to believe that they weren't in the 60s and 70s, but that's just a guess on my part. But she certainly had no warning that death was going to come, and for a lot of people it works that way as well. Even though we have a few contrasts between Ananias and Sapphira, let me toss this out for consideration as well. Did Peter know that Sapphira was going to die? Did Peter know that Sapphira was going to die? Yeah, I think we have to conclude from that, yes. Did he know that Ananias was going to die? I don't know. That's an interesting question for me. Not so sure about Ananias. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But when we come to Sapphira, most definitely, he was very aware that she was going to be leaving, and leaving in a hurry. Marcia?
Well, he didn't know for sure until she lied to him.
Yes.
Because he gave her that chance.
Right. Yeah, at that point, the deal was sealed. Now, with Ananias, again, very similar, but was it exactly the same? We're not quite sure. As you look at this account, some other lessons begin to emerge. We talk at various times about judgment being individual. I can't help you as far as, you know, the judgment when it comes to standing in your place. You can't stand in my place. Mom can't stand in there for the son, and the husband can't stand in there for the wife, and so forth. And you see judgment here. It's individual. Ananias has his shot at it. He blows it. Sapphira, she has her shot at it, and she blows it at as well. Another great lesson, I think, is God's ability to act immediately. Sometimes I believe that as people look at God, they think, well, you know, he sure takes a sweet old time. Maybe one of these days he'll kind of hear that prayer, or maybe one of these days God will act and intervene and so forth. But we've often made note of the fact that God's timing is not necessarily our timing. When you look at Acts 5, is God able to act immediately? Yes. So when it comes to God's timing, always bear in mind that he's going to work on a time frame that works best for him and ultimately best for us. When you look at the word which is translated immediate or immediately, it's an adverb. It almost always describes the miraculous immediacy of the manifestations of God's supernatural power. Some of the places where that occurs, remember Jesus cursed the fig tree not long before he died? How quickly did the fig tree die?
Immediately.
Now we can put some poison on a tree or something, and maybe if it's heavy poison, you can put some poison on a dandelion or some of the weed, and a few hours later it'll start to maybe wilt a little bit. You can go out there and see it's not looking so swell. But something that would happen that quick. So that would be another place. You have the man with palsy in Luke chapter 5. He was healed immediately. You have the woman who had the issue of blood, Luke 8, verse 44. She was healed immediately. The woman who couldn't straighten her back, I think she'd been hunched over for 18 years, if I remember that right, Luke 13, verse 13. She was healed immediately. The blind, Luke 18, verse 43, and a few other miracles that we read about, they were all immediate. There was no delay whatsoever. Something else that kind of stands out. As you do some comparing, as you look at verse 2, you have some information there about the feet of Peter. What's said in Acts 5, verse 2 about Peter's feet? All right, money was laid at the apostles' feet. Now, as you look at Acts chapter 5, the verses that we're looking at, plus maybe we'll need to deal with a couple more, what do we find about feet?
They fell at his feet.
Yeah, laid at the feet, now falling at the feet. And the feet that carried out Ananias were going to also now be involved with carrying out Sapphira. So I don't know if Luke's trying to tie all that together or not, but that's interesting that in just a few verses you have several reference to feet. If an uninspired person had written this book, generally you would expect to find what with Bible characters, especially this early in the history of the church? Would they be reporting bad stuff or good stuff about the characters? Early in the church's history? Want to cast things in a good, favorable, positive light? You know, you wouldn't want to have two of your members. And when you have a Christian or a Christian couple that's willing to sell some land, and even bring part of the price of the land. Just thinking of it in terms of basic logic, would you say that they're fairly heavily involved in the congregation? They really care? Yeah. When it comes to giving, if somebody's not that involved in a congregation, what would you probably expect when it comes to contribution time? Yeah, here's a dollar, or we'll just pass the plate, or here's a couple bucks, or I'm feeling real generous today. But somebody goes out and sells some land, they're probably fairly heavily involved. So if that's accurate reasoning, and for the most part I think that is generally when we deal with people and circumstances such as this, you have maybe not key members, but certainly noteworthy or significant members of the church, not just one of them, both of them, involved in this scandal, and they die. So again, you wouldn't find that in, I think, most uninspired works. One source said this is one of the stories which demonstrates the almost stubborn honesty of the Bible. And you have other passages, Old Testament and New, which help reveal that God showed the best and he showed the worst of his people, and you really get a pretty good sense of what folks were like in ancient times. Another lesson that comes to mind would be the one from Matthew chapter 6, verse 24. Remember in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, you can't have two, what? Masters. You can't serve God and money. Would you say that Ananias and Sapphira were trying to have two masters? Let's serve God. We love him, but also we want to make sure that we exercise control over part of the funds, and they did have two gods. And Peter made it very, very clear that that was not going to work very well. Three other quick lessons, and then we'll see what we have in Acts chapter 5, verse 11. When we look at people, and maybe not so much with members of the church, but when we look at people, do we find that individuals sometimes like to, and this is not just limited to religion, do we find that individuals sometimes like to offset sin or offset bad activities? Let's put it in terms of a child. Child wants something. Child has been bad all week. I mean, it's just been one thing after another. But now, Friday night, child wants to do something. Maybe there's a movie that's come out, or there's something else that's fun on Saturday. So the child's thinking, hey, I really want to do that. There's that school activity. I need the car, whatever it might be. What's the child going to do in hopes of getting mom or dad to offer up the car keys or take the child to the movie, whatever it might be? Uh-huh. Let's make that a little more specific. What do they do?
Butter them up.
How? You're right.
You've been wanting me to clean out the garage. Unless I got out there, I'll go do it now.
Or maybe they already cleaned the garage, and hey, the garage is clean. I washed the dishes. I vacuumed the house. I power washed the house. I cleaned out the car, whatever it might be. Well, as a parent, what do you think? They have done, and maybe some noteworthy items. I mean, yes, they did clean the garage, and yes, they did, power wash the house, and yes, they did do the dishes. They did all these things in hopes of buttering you up, and now it's all okay. Well, what are you thinking?
A little too late for that.
Yeah, it's a little too late. You should have been thinking about that earlier. Do you think that you can see a parallel between that and the spiritual realm? That there are people who believe that they can butter up God?
Well, it's not a checkbook.
Yes, you're exactly right. But that's how some people see it. Well, God, I did this, and I did this, and I did this. Therefore, you should be able to overlook this. You think Ananias and Sapphira, can you hold your thought for a second? Do you think Ananias and Sapphira could have made a case for their goodness?
But they didn't, right?
Well, but
they didn't say they did.
Okay.
But
in their minds, I guess, that's where I'm going. Were they interested in helping the poor?
Sure.
Okay. That a good thing?
Yes.
Is God interested in that?
Yes.
Sure. Okay, so they could say, we're willing to help the poor. And are we willing to help the poor in a significant way?
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know how much the land was worth, but I mean, unless it was just wasteland, there surely was, and they had the ability to hold back some money. And were they willing to make a donation to the local congregation? Yes, and from what we can tell, that probably was a sizable donation. And the only thing God had to accept was what? This little lie.
Oh,
Their mind. In their mind. That was the trade-off. We'll do this, and this, and this. And it's going to be okay because, we're holding some back, but no big deal. And God says, one's died, and now you've both died. And yet, I find that fascinating that a lot of people still today sort of barter with God. Well, will have all these things lined up, and therefore, God, you'll excuse me in these areas. Don't try it. Has anybody seen that as far as a secular job? They come around with their pledge drive for a certain donation, and they're looking for a hefty contribution, and people actually... I've seen that in the service, not so much the secular jobs that I've had. But you have seen that in the world as well?
I have.
Okay, at least a few. And that really is slimy. And then it really gets bad if the person says, okay, I'll give 10% of my income, and then after the sign-up process is over, they go back and they cancel it. Yeah. So, again, it's not new. People have been doing that kind of thing for a long time. So that's lesson number one. Let's take a look at a second lesson. When we listen to people, and I'll make this point briefly in the sermon, I think, as well today. But when you listen to people, especially when someone dies and they were not a Christian, invariably you are told or you hear what? He was a good person. I'd like you to take something home today, if not from the Bible class, from the sermon, or both. The Bible doesn't say the good people are going to be saved, does it? Jesus didn't say the good in heart shall inherit the kingdom of God. Who did he say? The, well, that's not a bad word, but there's even a better word. The pure in heart. Would you say that there's a difference between the good and the pure? Yeah, there's a big difference. Now, the world may not. Well, good, pure, I mean, one word's as good as another. Well, that's not true when it comes to salvation. So the next time you hear that from somebody, oh, he was a good person. Let your mind come back to today's class. Goodness, purity, not the same thing. And goodness is not the standard to go to heaven. Anybody have a thought on that before we move down a little bit more? Okay, let me give you this other point. This comes from an author. He says, it's easy for us to condemn Ananias and Sapphira for their dishonesty. I think that's probably been done by a lot of Christians, maybe every Christian at one time or another. But we need to examine our own lives to see if our profession is backed up by our practice. Do we sing the hymns and gospel songs sincerely or routinely? What about the other parts of our worship? So it is, as we look at what happened to these two, it is a good reminder for us to always be looking at our motives, to make sure that it's not a show, to make sure that it's not just going through the motions, to make sure that there's not something pretend about it, that we are the real deal. Anybody else before we look at Acts 5:11? Stan?
The sheep from the goats, and they, the ones that he rejected, said, "Have we not done many mighty works?" For some reason or another, I've always equated that to the good people.
Yeah, they would certainly fit, but impure, because for the most part they did not enter into Christ. And that goodness is just not going to work. And he makes the point that many will make that claim, and he doesn't deny it. But it's just that you're in the wrong relationship. So that personal goodness ultimately accounts for nothing. But there are people who just live their lives to help others. They're benevolent, they're kind, they're giving. And in some circumstances, they give more, they do more than a Christian. I mean, we had yesterday, this will tie in a little bit to a sermon a week from today, and also for the Columbia City Lectureship. But we had neighbors out. We had a work day yesterday. We also are scheduled for a work day next Saturday. And about halfway through, I just set down my rake and surveyed things for a little bit. And I thought, look at the people out here. We have males. We have females. We have some younger people, probably from about the age of 7, I'm guessing, somewhere up into the mid-60s. And people brought out their carts. People brought out their they weren't lawn tractors, but sort of the four-wheel carts that you can use to take things. People brought out chainsaws, pruners, flamethrowers. That was my contribution. just a lot of different items, and we spent 4 hours out there. We burned a lot of brush, cleared a lot of stuff, and they were very giving of their time. Nobody got any pay for it, and we had a good time, and I think they would have been willing to come out for probably 3 or 4 Saturdays. But again, that goodness doesn't equate to anything when it comes to the eternal realm. So a lot of good people will be lost. Anybody else? Okay, let's move down to Acts chapter 5 and see what we have in verse 11. And a great fear came upon the whole church and upon all that heard these things. Unless all that heard these things would be a reference to Christians outside the area of Jerusalem, it seems to me that you have to understand that as a reference to people who were non-Christians there in the area of Jerusalem. It happens. With our robbery, I don't know if you saw it in the news. I didn't think to check that until a couple of days ago, but we made the Goshen news. Kind of wish that that hadn't happened, but we did make the news. So there are some non-Christians in the area that know that we got robbed. And that happens with some other things. Non-Christians will hear about something, and it moves beyond the ears of the members of a local congregation. In this case, the people heard, and what was their reaction? They had not just fear, but presumably the non-Christians, they had great fear. And that's significant. That was for the saved. That was also for the unsaved. We talked about this a little bit last time, and I want to look at it from a different perspective. Let's go back to the book of Deuteronomy for a second. We'll look at Deuteronomy 13, 17, 19, and Deuteronomy 21. In the Old Testament, you have this principle taught. We mentioned from Ecclesiastes 8 a week ago that justice needs to be executed speedily for it to be a deterrent. But you also have these passages in Deuteronomy which make it very clear that when there is justice, especially if life is taken for a serious punishment, that that is a deterrent. Let's see if we can get a helper to read. Gary, you're going to be reading multiple references. Do you want to help us out here?
Sure.
Okay. We'll start with Deuteronomy 13. We'll take a look at Deuteronomy chapter 13, verses 6 through 11. And then after Deuteronomy 13, 6 through 11, we'll jump over, Gary, to Deuteronomy chapter 17. But we'll start with chapter 13, starting with 6, going down through 11.
If thy brother, the son of thy mother, or thy son, or thy daughter, or the wife of thy bosom, or thy friend, which is as thine own soul, entice thee secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which thou hast not known, thou, nor thy fathers, namely of the gods of the people which are round about you, nigh unto thee, or far off from thee, from one end of the earth even unto the end of the earth, thou shalt not consent unto him, nor hearken unto him, neither shall thine eye pity him, neither shalt thou spare, neither shalt thou conceal him. But thou shalt surely kill him. Thine hand shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. And thou shalt stone him with stones, that he die, because he hath sought to thrust thee away from the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage. And all Israel shall hear in fear, and shall do no more any such wickedness as this is among you.
Okay, now 2 points from that long reading. Thank you very much. Point number one, God said there may be someone who tries to lead you into false religion. That's a very serious matter. How serious is it? God said if somebody pulls that, do what to him? Kill him. And then he says what? You take that life, the consequence will be all Israel shall fear. That's exactly what you have over in Acts chapter 5. All right, Gary, let's move forward a couple of chapters. Deuteronomy chapter 17, let's look at verses 12 and 13. Yeah.
And all the people shall hear and fear and do no more presumptuously.
Okay, the people shall hear and the people shall fear. You're going to have that sin checked. All right, 2 chapters later, if you would, Deuteronomy 19, verses 18 through 20.
And the judges shall make diligent inquisition. And behold, if the witness be a false witness and hath testified falsely against his brother, then shall ye do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. So shalt thou put the evil away from among you, and those which remain shall hear and fear, and shall henceforth commit no more any such evil among you. And thine eye shall not pity, but life shall go for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot.
Okay, when people see someone getting away with something, kids are again the classic example. Johnny gets away with it, Susie sees it, so what's Susie think? If it worked for him, it's going to work for me. And God makes that point about justice. It's got to be dealt with. People have to be dealt with. And it's got to be swift, sure, and certain. Otherwise, you'll have problems. And then one more, if you would, Gary. Deuteronomy 21, starting with verse 18 and going through 21.
If a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, which will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and that when he has chastened them, will not hearken unto them, then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him and bring him out unto the elders of his city and unto the gate of his place. And they shall say unto the elders of his city, This our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. And all the men of his city shall stone him with stones, that he die. So shall thou put evil away from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear.
Again, the same idea, but a different context. So you have the fellow who's the stubborn and the rebellious son. God said if he is allowed to continue in his activities, it's going to spread. You've got to stop it. And that also happens on the world stage as well. You have a rogue nation, or you have some foolish dictator that thinks I'm going to, you know, go past the red line, or I'm not going to follow the rules, and I'll just continue to push and push. And if you don't have leaders who are willing to stand up and push back and enforce consequences, it's just like God says, and it becomes a serious problem. Anything else that you want to discuss before we turn our attention to something else? Jeff?
The justice was carried out swiftly in all these cases.
Yes. Yeah, it wasn't, well, he's going to get 6 months or 10 years of appeals, and then we'll finally figure it out. No. And Ananias, you have that same principle here. It's not, well, let's have a church council, and in 6 months we'll go ahead and figure out what to do with them. It just needs to be dealt with immediately. Otherwise, you lose the force. So, excellent thought. Anybody else? Okay, the word church. You have that, I believe, used in Acts chapter 5, verse 11. And a great fear came upon the whole church. Aside from the lips of Jesus, this is the first time that we have the word church used by a New Testament author. Now, if you have the King James translation, you'll find that word church back in Acts chapter 2, verse 47. I'm not counting it, though, because the manuscript reading for that is doubtful. But you have that word used 23 times in the New Testament. And it's an interesting word because for us, we may think the church was first introduced by Jesus and the apostles, but that's not true. The word church existed 5 centuries before Jesus came into the world. Now think about that. Church existed 5 centuries before Jesus came into the world. Now how that worked was the pagans used that word. And they used that word to describe an assembly, a gathering of people. People were called out. They're in Greek free cities. There were lawful assemblies. And you have that in Acts chapter 19 three times. Acts chapter 19, verses 32, 39, and 41. There was the assembly, and that was not a Christian assembly. It wasn't the church in the sense that we think of it. But there were people who congregated, people who came out as a group. And when you go back and you look in the Old Testament, sometimes we talk about the Septuagint. That's the Greek translation of the Old Testament scriptures. You will have in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, that word ecclesia or that word church, and describes the assembly of God's people. So long, long history of church before we get to the New Testament era. Most in here should be well aware of the fact that when we think of a church, we are not thinking of what? Somebody says, let's go to the church. Well, yeah. It's easy to fall into that trap because of how the world uses that word. Try not, especially if you have kids or grandkids, try to make a mental note that we're going to add the word building there. Let's go to the church building, the place where the assembly meets, that building, that structure. We have that in the sign. This is the place where we meet. It's not the church. And the church, there are, of course, the people who are known by the Lord and the one body, the people who are headed by Christ, the people who are holding to the truth. A lot of different descriptions for the church in the New Testament. Paul described it as the pillar and the ground of truth. And as you look at the church in the New Testament, you have at least 3 passages which say the church met where?
Houses.
Yeah. You've got that over in the book of Romans, Romans chapter 16, verse 5, at the end of 1 Corinthians 16, verse 19, and at the end of Colossians, Colossians chapter 4, verse 15. In those 3 places, Paul talked about the church which meets in your house or the church which meets in their house. Now, there have been some ideas as far as why they did that, and I think it makes good sense. In the first century, you not only have things like persecution, but you have Christianity beginning to spread. You might have one member, maybe the wife or maybe an older child becomes a Christian. if you wanted to let the other family members know, and maybe even the people in your neighborhood know, about how to become a Christian, where would be perhaps a good meeting place?
Your house.
Your house. Unsaved husband or your unsaved wife or the kids who haven't become Christians, chances are that's going to spill over a little bit. When we think about houses today, it's a good bit different. I don't know, what would you say an average house has in our area as far as square footage?
Ours is 1,500.
I was thinking around 1,500 would probably be a pretty good ballpark. You're going to have some obviously smaller, some obviously larger, but 1,500. And if you wanted to have an assembly there, could you be divided off?
Yeah, we could.
Sure. I mean, you could be back in one of the bedrooms, or you could be on the kitchen end of the house or in the living room, and people would be able to go in a lot of different areas, and they might miss the assembly. But in the first century, what were houses like as far as a general house?
Pretty much all one room.
Yeah, you're pretty much all room. If you've ever gone to a museum, maybe they had an area, a display area, where they had, the Indians out there, and you've got the little hut, and maybe you were able to see the beds. In some foreign countries, it's like that today. I've been on some mission trips where we had, in what you would classify as a one-room apartment, maybe 25 people. And, I mean, you just start stacking people on the floor, or you push four or five people into a bed, and it gets kind of cozy, but it does work. So when people have, even for one individual, 13, 14, 1,500 square feet compared to a lot of people in the world, that is a huge amount of space. But if you're packing them all into a one room, especially if the weather's not good, they're going to hear part of the assembly, and I think that was probably one of the things that helped the gospel grow. So those church homes, if you will, church houses, were very, very helpful. As you look at church buildings, you have to go about 100 years past the day of Pentecost to find any kind of church building, any kind of record of one. And the first ones supposedly were east of Damascus. They do say that as you go back and you look at some of those older buildings, that they had baptistries built into them, which obviously would have been used to immerse people. But there's kind of a fascinating history there as far as church buildings. So if they could get by for the first 100 or so years without a church building, do you think we could today?
Yes.
Yeah. So in America, that may not be the best setup for a lot of reasons, but in foreign countries, a lot of times, they don't have a church building, and they get along just fine. Anything you want to add or ask before we look at Acts chapter 5, verse 12?
I've wondered from time to time how they preached for long hours back in those days, and they, because of the one-room thing, I thought, well, maybe that's why they preached so long. They could have been preaching to different age groups, and because there would not be any separation for, like we have Bible class now and such.
That's possible, where they were going to focus on some things. We're going to talk to young people for a little while, and now we're going to talk to the married, and now we're going to talk to the unmarried, and now we're going to talk to the senior citizens. Yeah, and that's very possible, since you didn't have a Bible. I imagine that if they could have some of those marathon, today it happens. Look at a congregation that has a seminar. They'll say, we're going to have an all-day Saturday seminar. Now, that's not something we do every weekend, but here we have a chance to hear someone special. They have some specific information. And in principle, it seems to me that you would have, as far as people like Paul or Peter coming, and they were not a regular in the area, that yes, this is our opportunity to spend a lot of time with him, get a lot of information, and that's going to help us for a long time. So that's very easy to see. I think so. And you see in principle, when you look back, you think back into the 1800s, the medicine show rolls into town or some other things, the circus comes into town. That's a special event. And people are willing to set aside what they're doing to go. In that case, it's entertainment. But the same principle, someone has come to town, they're going to preach the gospel. Even if you go back into the late 1800s in this country, the 1900s, early 1900s, the Brush Arbor meetings, where they would go out for 2, 3, 4 weeks at a time. There were some areas where New Testament Christianity was a new concept. And people would go and just, I mean, they would camp out for days and days, and you might have multiple people preach. Or some guy might stand up and preach for 3 or 4 hours, and maybe they all break for lunch then. But yeah, this was a distinctive time to go out and hear that. So also very, very easy to see how that would have probably factored in. Yeah. And once you, I don't know if you've ever been in an environment where people were given the chance to just ask question after question after question. Sometimes that can drag on, but a lot of times people have some really good questions, especially if there's something that is still somewhat new. And, I mean, you can wrap up a lot of time in question and answer sessions. So that probably was a big part of what happened as well. Virginia?
Mm-hmm. And it was just one room, the size of this room. And the classes, a few would be over here in their age group, and they were all over the building. And that's the way they had their classes.
Like a one-room schoolhouse, almost.
And they didn't have electricity. There was no indoor plumbing. They had to go outside.
If you lived in a country like India and you're walking for the Sunday morning service, maybe an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours, and you've got to walk back home, an hour, 2 hours, or 3 hours, and the guy preaches for 20 minutes, how would you feel?
Let down.
I think you'd feel let down. Now, it might be the greatest sermon in the world, and you might learn all kinds of great things, but still, 6 hours hike for a 20-minute lesson, you're kind of thinking, I really wanted to make a day of this. Now, if you look at him and you think, well, he wanted at least an hour sermon or a 2 hour sermon or a 3 hour sermon, you can understand why. But if you switch cultures, here's somebody, life has a lot of activities packed into it, their kids and everything else, and we've got transportation where we can move around fairly quickly, and the preacher says, okay, we're going to have a 3 hour sermon every Sunday we meet. How do you think that we'll go over here? Probably not too well. So culture has a lot to play into this. And when you go back and you start looking at how that culture was arranged and transportation, certainly in my mind would have factored into this as well. The people thought, we want to, so to speak, get our money's worth or get our time's worth. And you can understand that. You can appreciate that. But always try to bear in mind the culture in which we live. Ray, did you have a thought back there?
I did about it over the top. I think about the story of Gehazi, Naaman and things, when this Gehazi, 2 Kings, the 5th chapter, he wanted that, what Naaman had to offer, and he lied about it too. Like a prophet.
Yeah. And there's, it goes back to what we said in Matthew 6, verse 24. You can't have God and money as your master. But there have been a lot of people who thought that they could and thought that they'd try. Anybody else? Dolores?
Is it true that, you know, when we talked about we preached all night so far that we would just fall asleep? When that first started, though, didn't they still have regular jobs on the first day of the week?
A lot of them, when you look at a lot of the people who were converts, many of them were slaves. And
so
if you were a slave...
You know, when you talk about preaching all day and preaching all night, some of them may not have started on Sunday morning at 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
They may have to come after work.
Yeah. Yeah, and that really speaks well as far as speaks well of the people as far as a commitment. You're a slave, and it wasn't like, well, hey, I'm ready for a break. You got a break if the master gave you a break, and you may have put in a 8, 10, 12, 15 hour day, and then to show up for services and still try to get something out of it. I mean, it was definitely a different culture, and you see great commitment there. All right, we're going to shut it down for today.